Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hagan. I'm working at
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hello, everybody. Chuck Bonnell, Julie Hayden on a nice winter's day. Chuck and Julie's grassroots show, Truth Straight Up.
This show is brought to you by Mountain West Wellness, Advanced Acupuncture, and Chinese Medicine. We're going to have a Todd Sheets, a financial expert, coming up here as soon as Thomas gets him on the phone. He has a new book out, 2008, What Really Happened. And I think he's talking about the housing crisis. And also looking
financial,
the financial. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And he could talk about the Trump economy and what we can maybe hopefully do about that. We've got Trump commenting on the drones. Trump held a news conference today. There was one funny part where some reporter says, would you issue a preemptive strike on Iran? And the president said, is that a serious question? He said, what should I say, yes or no on that? He said, that's not a particularly strategic point, so I'm not going to answer that. More on that. And then the South Colorado GOP has set up an anti-corruption a committee. But first, we got Todd Sheets with us. As I said, Todd, a financial expert. He's got a new book out, 2008, What Really Happened Regarding the Housing and Financial Crisis. So, hey, Todd, thank you.
Hey, Todd.
Welcome to the Chuck and Julie Show. Look, are you there? Oh, is your phone muted? Okay. Hey, Todd.
So.
Oh, there you go. Hey,
Yay.
Welcome to the Chuck and Julie Show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you guys this afternoon.
Well, okay. So 2008, what really happened, I think all I know is what I've seen about this is in the movies. Although I know I like completely... I lucked out in that in terms of the housing thing. And we kind of did too. But what happened and how do we avoid that going into the future? Because from what I recall, it wasn't like it was all like accidental or nobody's fault, right?
No, that's definitely true. That comes out in the book very much. Yes.
So how close in your mind or how good do you think the movie The Big Short was?
Well, I think the movie was very entertaining. The book that it was based on was very interesting. It gave a very important insight into one segment of what happened. But as so often occurs when we get these very interesting anecdotal type tales, based on one or a few people's experience during the crisis, it doesn't necessarily tell us what exactly caused the crisis.
Okay.
It might give us a perspective that, yes, did things get taken too far in the lending markets with the no-doc loans and excessive leveraging and pushing out loans that shouldn't have been made, all those kinds of things. All those things did happen. But we also have to step back and ask, why did they happen at that point in time in the housing market? Housing market had operated for like over 100 years. Had always been very predictable, kind of reliable generators of wealth. I call them the Joe DiMaggio of the investment markets in the book. But then all of a sudden in 1998, housing started acting in a very different way, and home prices started accelerating much more quickly than they had throughout history or in the four prior years. And so that's really where I zero in the book on like, okay, what really caused that event to happen in 1998?
Tell us what it is.
It
kind of begs the question, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, if we look at housing prices in the 4 years prior to 1998, just like they had throughout history, they had tracked very closely with inflation. But then in 98, we saw home prices move up to where all of a sudden they were increasing over 4 percentage points above inflation, which was historically unprecedented. In 1998, the other thing that happened was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two huge national housing finance companies, which were set up by the government, and extended special governmental privileges that gave them a borrowing advantage in the marketplace, which they were supposed to pass on to low to moderate income home buyers. Those two entities engaged on a substantial expansion of their mission. And so, like what happened with housing prices, they had been growing at about 7% a year in the years leading up to 1998. And then all of a sudden, and very dramatically, they changed and started growing at well in excess of 15% in that year. So, and that sustained itself for the next 4 years as well. So all of a sudden, they went on a huge expansion of their mission, started pushing a lot more money out into the housing markets. And that's really what triggered what I call in the book, the liftoff phase of the bubble, which is the first 4 years of when the bubble got started.
Now, so this is the government basically then started like throwing money at things. And
well, I mean, wasn't it, you know, as usual, misplaced or something hidden as being a altruistic thing, get people who weren't in the housing market before into the housing market? How do you get them in there? Well, you lower all the standards, no deposits, you know, the whole no checking on income, no anything else. That makes you eligible for a lot of things that were before you weren't eligible.
Yes. Yeah, so those things especially came later in the 2000s during what I call the acceleration phase. I think in this early stage, you guys are exactly right, though. This was a well-intentioned effort by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who had grown gradually over the decades leading up to this, to the point where they controlled so much of the housing market, almost not quite 50% of single family home loans were either made by or guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And so, and their Fannie Mae's leader, Franklin Raines, I go through a story about him in the book. He came from a low income family in Seattle. His dad lost his job, had to go on government aid, basically took any work he could find. And during this period of time, you know, he was industrious enough to go out and buy lumber that he salvaged from an abandoned home and built on a very inexpensive lot over a five-year period of time by himself, by hand. And Franklin grew up in that environment and saw how much wealth that home helped the family generate, how much it did for their family. He went on, was a brilliant guy, went to Harvard undergrad, Harvard Law School, worked in the Clinton and Carter administrations. And in between that, worked at Fannie Mae and then came back to run Fannie Mae in the late 90s. So he was one of the architects of this major expansion. And as you suggest, I think he had the best interest of low and moderate income families in mind. But unfortunately, as so often happens, you know, these things eventually go in a very different direction than what is initially intended, and they end up hurting the people they were designed to help in the first place, which is what ultimately ended up happened here.
How much of that was this just like altruistic bureaucrats sitting around, or what kind of role, if any, did, say, the lending institutions play?
Before we get to that, what did he do? What did Franklin Raines do to start this massive downfall of society? I mean, what was his original concepts and how did they become perverted?
Well, the original concept was Fannie and Freddie were both created by Congress to try and provide funding to low to moderate income families to help them buy a home. So they were designed to provide, slightly lower interest rates than they could have gotten if interest rates had been set at market level. And they, for a long period of time, had more or less pursued that mission without having a substantial impact in the housing markets. But then we get to the mid-90s, and in particular, 1998, and they decide to dramatically expand that mission and make much more money available than they had before. So they go to Congress, and one of the things is they get increases authorized in their lending limits. You know, they had limits on the size or the price of a home that they could lend on. And then they also, as I show in the book, they effectively lowered interest rates relative to their cost of the money that they were borrowing to provide funds to the housing industry. And that's what then kicked off this big initial surge in demand, which drove the first leg, the liftoff phase of the housing bubble.
And explain a little bit of the history of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and how they're different and everything else.
You would like me to go into that?
Yeah.
Just a little, briefly, just so people know.
Briefly. I mean, it's right now it's critical. I mean, since they began the demise of America.
Yeah. So, Fannie Mae was created during the Great Depression and the New Deal wave of legislation to provide housing finance to the country back in the 1930s, but remained a small and insignificant part of the whole housing market. And this was true all the way up to the late 1960s, when Fannie and all other government agencies at that time were still represented something less than 6% of housing finance. But in the late 60s, the government was undergoing a period of time where they were incurring deficits because of the spending on the Great Society programs and the Vietnam War, both of which kind of came together under Johnson's administration. There were some issues in housing finance that had developed around the country as a result of the banking regulatory model that was set up during the Great Depression, which tended to limit deposits in certain areas of the country, primarily the Northeast and the upper Midwest, that had a wealth and an excess of deposits, but didn't provide a mechanism for those funds to flow into some of the faster growing areas of the country that had emerged, you know, in the aftermath of the Depression, areas like Florida and California. So Congress was sitting there in the late 60s. This is a big issue. This is not like a, like I say in the book, this isn't a mere matter of high finance. You know, you've got a lot of voters moving to Florida and California with not enough money available to them to buy homes and that kind of thing. So the solution they came up with was they didn't want the government itself to be borrowing even more money, because as I said, they were already trying to fund the Great Society and the Vietnam War. So they pushed Fannie Mae off the government's books and turned it into a privately owned enterprise or institution or company, whatever we want to call it. Mm-hmm. And its shares were traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And Freddie Mac was created at the same time, basically in Fannie's image to provide a competitor. And then even though they were private companies, the government gave them special privileges, which basically signaled to the financing markets that if you're lending money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and either one of them ever gets into a significant bind or problem, we will probably bail you out. They couldn't guarantee that they would bail them out, or that would have shown up on the government's books, but this was kind of a wink and a nod kind of thing.
Right.
And then those privileges and that signaling basically allowed them to borrow at cheaper interest rates than other sources of housing finance could borrow at, which allowed them to provide loans at slightly lower rates, which benefited low to medium income homebuyers. And with those privileges in place, that allowed them to grow substantially. So they went from less than 6% of the mortgage market up to, by the mid-90s, like I mentioned, you know, not quite 50%, but well above 40% of the housing market. So that's
So Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were simply competitors. There was no differences between them.
They were two separate companies that were essentially both sponsored by the government with the same privileges and competed against each other and other players in the housing market that didn't have those special privileges. Yes. Okay. And Congress continued to have oversight of those entities as well, in a way that they didn't have with other private institutions, and in part because they knew, you know, if these guys screwed up, this could be a very expensive thing for the government if it ever does have to step in and bail them out, which is what ended up happening when the bubble.
Right. Yeah. What kind of role, if any, did, say, developers play or financial lending institutions in pushing, you know, because it seems to me like they're like, hey, there's this, if I'm a developer, they're like, there's this whole market out here we're not even reaching. But if I can get the government to help me help them, that's a win-win. I mean, did that play a role in that at all?
Yeah, I'm sure that you know those kinds of things were going on. I mean, you know, once you set up those kinds of things, you've got to get the money to the people, and there's a bunch of people in the chain that are out there, you know, trying to encourage and help people to buy homes and take advantage of these programs and that kind of thing. So,
So what in 1998, Raines, how does he expand the reach of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae?
Well, basically, they effectively lower their interest rate relative to their cost of funds, which makes financing a home more affordable and enables them to dramatically increase the amount of money that they are lending into the marketplace.
But
And
where do they
so
get the
all
additional money now that they? What do they change to get all this additional money they could push out into the market?
yeah, where'd they get the money? Us.
Yeah, effectively, they're making home loans even cheaper than they had been before.
But where'd they get their
And
money?
so they're borrowing, you know, from investors who are buying debt in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're, both of those entities are very highly leveraged, as most finance companies are. So they're, you know, issuing bonds in the marketplace and other forms of debt that are being bought by individuals, by governments, by international governments, and all those kinds of things.
Well,
And so they start.
how did the market for those bonds increase for them in order to lend money again out to the housing market at a lower
Yeah, I
rate?
think, you know, that was not a difficult thing for them to do, because I think for two big things, and these are great questions, but they were able to start borrowing significantly more than they had in the past. Because one, everybody was operating kind of under the assumption that the national housing market was not going to go through a major bust. You know, there was 100 years of history. We didn't have national housing booms and busts. We had localized ones occasionally, but
Right.
not on a national basis. And so everybody just assumed, and this continued all the way through the bubble, even in, you know, the most sophisticated financial institutions were working with these models of housing that just didn't show a bust happening, because one had never happened in all the data that they were building their models off of. So that was one factor. And then the second factor was this issue that I mentioned, you know, that was there from the time that they were created by Congress, or expanded by Congress, in the late 60s and early 70s, was that because they had this these special government privileges, it was generally believed by people lending money to them that even if they ever did get to the point of failure for some unexpected reason, the federal government would step in and bail out the people who were loaning money to them.
Yeah.
And so this was seen in the market as not quite as secure as lending money to the government itself, but just slightly below that. And
So that was.
so they were able to borrow at very attractive rates and in very large quantities, and dramatically increase their borrowing because of these factors.
I remember at the time, like I said, I was buying, and the real estate agent, and I was doing okay, but I wasn't, you know, a millionaire. And he wanted to show me some like $450,000 house, something outrageous like that, right? And I said, no, I can't. There's no way I could afford it. I wouldn't even qualify for the loan. He goes, you wouldn't believe what they're giving people. And then I said, yeah, but I could never really afford it. He goes, that doesn't seem to matter these days, you know? He's like, it was insane.
Well, that's later. That's later.
Well, but let me, well, it's right about 2000, right about.
No, it wouldn't have been because he's saying this early stage, they have not let down all their standards in order to increase everything. They've just got more money so they can lend to more homes and everything else, and then there's a true liftoff. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there was this initial phase, which I called the liftoff of the bubble, driven by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And then I think the second phase you're referring to, Julie, I think, started in 2002. And
Okay.
2002 through 2005, the second critical mistake that was made, you know, by the system, the first was letting these agencies run wild like they started to. The second one was then, I don't know if you guys remember, but the tech stock bubble, or the dot-com bubble of the late 90s, collapsed in early 2000.
Right.
When that happened, the Federal Reserve reacted to that. They wanted to minimize the impact of that on the economy. which they tried to do by significantly lowering short-term interest rates. And what they didn't realize that they were doing was creating a huge second incentive for people to pile into the housing market, because right, we already had homes appreciating much faster than they normally would. And then the Fed drove down short-term interest rates, which made it possible to buy a home with a, these were adjustable rate mortgages,
right,
what people right called them. And so you could all of a sudden, whereas in the past you would have taken out, you know, a long-term, maybe 30-year fully amortizing loan at a higher interest rate, now all of a sudden we see this huge level of demand increasing for these short-term adjustable rate mortgages, where the interest rate was tied to short-term rates that were controlled by the Federal Reserve. And so this dynamic, where you can buy a home that's appreciating at, let's say, 6 or 7% a year and finance it with a mortgage that is only carrying interest at, like, let's say, 3% a year, a variable rate mortgage, that drove a huge amount of money into the market. And that's where we then started to really see, you know, this significant lack of discipline take place
right
throughout the system.
And that's what, Jacob, one of our, you don't see, we have, we're on Zoom, and so our listeners are kind of typing in, and Jacob is saying, Julie, you were offered an ARM cheap loan, exactly what you just described, Todd, with the interest rate balloons. That's exactly what it was, Jacob. One of our other callers, and this is it's kind of coming into current times, and she says, is BlackRock getting cheap money to buy real estate while moms and pops have to pay 6% on mortgages, thereby forcing a renter nation? Do you have any insight or any thoughts on that? I guess kind of bringing things to pay.
Yeah, sure. There are some things happening. I mean, you know, a renter nation is being, you know, kind of forced on the country again, because we do have housing affordability issues now. And I think part of what's happened is we failed to learn the proper lessons from the financial crisis. And so we continued some policies, which have now resulted in high home prices again. And, if, you know, we've got an affordability crisis. BlackRock is a huge financial institution based in New York City. It's completely private, does not benefit from any of the kind of special government privileges that we were talking about with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And so, you know, I don't think BlackRock is the source of these problems now. I think, you know, if we wanted to look at the source of these problems, we're again, in large part, looking at the, you know, very low, easy money interest rate policies that the Federal Reserve followed in the aftermath of the financial crisis, again, to try and moderate its impact on the economy. And that has then continued for the last decade, and especially in the last 4 years when we, you know, they helped provide the cash that funded a lot of the government deficits that we've run.
What would you, yes, this is from Jacob, was saying, he said, I worked at the foreclosure desk at the public trustee's office. You would not believe the loan offers that people bought houses with. Yeah, that's what I was saying. They're like, you could buy this mansion. Well, let me ask you, because we've only got a few more minutes here.
Let's continue. We just really started into this. So what is, our house has doubled in
right,
the last
that's what
few,
I was gonna
few
ask,
years
yeah,
and so forth. What is causing that? Is that the lack of home availability and the cost of construction?
It's a good investment on our part.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Were we geniuses?
Yeah, that's what you'd like to hear, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things. I think, you touched on a couple of them. I think one, we have had a significant and sustained increase in the cost of building homes.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things, and this kind of started with globalization in the early 2000s, where, you know, you could move the manufacturing of a lot of items overseas, which brought down consumer price inflation, but you couldn't move the construction of a home overseas.
Right.
So we've seen continued inflation in the cost of construction for the last 15 or 20 years, which has kind of changed the dynamics to some extent, because in the past, you know, you get a big increase in home prices and you're going to have a lot of people building new homes because they can build them and sell them at a big profit at that point in time.
Right.
That brings the development community into the marketplace. So that has altered things. And then at the same time, as you mentioned, a lot of this happened in the last 4 to 5 years. Well, that's the period of time when we started running very big government deficits. The Federal Reserve, as it also made the mistake of doing in the past, in part funded those deficits by printing money and pushing it into the system. That's easy money coming into the system. And a lot of that, some of it showed up in consumer prices this time. You know, that triggered that increase that everybody was so frustrated about in the last election. But I think many people don't understand that some of that money has also, you know, in the last 4 to 5 years, caused this big acceleration in home prices again.
Right.
So, you know, we've got
and,
this.
And why did construction go up so much? Costs. Why did construction costs over the last 5 years increase so much?
Yeah, you know, I think that we're just looking at the consequences of, you know, 20 years of, you know, continued inflation and escalation in housing construction costs all being built into the system and that kind of thing.
But why did the construction costs go up so much? Why did the lumber cost so much? Why did the labor go up? Why did all the things that go into a home?
What role did COVID play in that too? Because I mean, we for whatever, I had friends who were doing building and it just jumped. And some of it was there was less being produced in part because everybody was, you know, everybody was staying home. Did that contribute to it too? Just sort of the government lockdowns?
Yeah, I'm sure it did. Actually, you know, some of these are good questions. These are areas where I probably need to do a little bit more research on some of these more recent trends and what was really the driver in what's happened, you know, in the period after I wrote the book.
Right.
Yeah, but in general, you know, we are dealing with high construction costs, I think, which limit new home construction, and then with very high housing prices. And then there's two other elements to all of this. One is interest rates. You know, what interest rate can you borrow at? That affects affordability. Those are relatively low right now. Not as low as they were for a while, but they're relatively low. So it's, you know, this isn't like some earlier periods when we had double-digit interest rates that made affordability very difficult. And then the other factor that's out there that we have to talk about is incomes. And so all of these things are a function of, you know, the cost of existing homes, the cost of creating new homes, which affects the supply of homes in the marketplace, the interest rate that a buyer can borrow at, and the incomes that buyers have. And, you know, we're all very aware, and I think some of the frustrations that you know, evidenced themselves in this last election were that, you know, incomes just haven't kept up with the inflation that we've seen.
Right.
In a lot of these areas. And so that stresses affordability as well.
Right, right. Well, what did you have anything else you wanted?
Well, I got 1,000 things, but we don't know.
No, we'll have to have you back on because there's so many. And this is a topic, I mean, home issues always hit home, so to speak. But so your book, 2008, What Really Happened, Todd Sheets is the author. Todd, where can people get your book?
Yeah, probably the easiest place is Amazon, and it's also available from the publisher, which is Encounter Books.
All right. Listen, well, please promise
you
come back.
Yeah, we just service.
We've got tons of questions and tons of other stuff for you, but we have to let you go now. So thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate your helping get the word out on what really happened here. So,
All right. No, thank you. We've got tons of comment. I mean, this is from Jim Jackson. Regulation, environmental laws increase construction costs. That's really true. And Charlene says, so BlackRock self-funds its own mortgages, therefore they can offer top dollar, crowding out mom and pop. Thanks, Jerome Powell. Jacob says another big problem is Green Valley Ranch in Forest City. The original homes were sold for $500,000 on a given model. Prices started to go down a bit. So if a buyer bought the home using a cheap arm, then 2 years later, the borrower got a new job out of state, had to put the property up for sale. Underfoot, the property owner is model home went down in price. The sale would not cover the mortgage. Instant foreclosure. I covered a ton of those. The bank, you know, the bankruptcies and the foreclosures were like skyrocketing, particularly in Adams County and Green Valley Ranch, places like that, right? Leo said, great guess. Yeah. Great questions too, Chuck. The Federal Reserve knew from Charlene it wasn't transitory inflation. It was all free money printed during COVID, too much money chasing too few goods. And one of you, I forget which one, pointed out way back up in the comments, we can't see him, but I think this is true, that every debacle can be somewhat traced to government interference, right? That may start with good intentions.
There are plenty of debacles that happen without government interference. I mean, and the markets go way up and go way down on their own. I mean, they don't need the government to do that. When government tries to regulate those huge ups and downs, because that causes such dislocations, then they create their own problems. But they're always tulip explosions. There's always the great Mississippi land explosion. There's always, you know, the capitalist system is a boom and bust system. And governments have, in part, gone in there, in theory anyway, to make sure that there isn't that enormous boom and bust. But then they become corrupted, or even if they do it in good faith,
right?
It creates its own problem.
Before we move on to the whole housing affordability thing, is such a joke, because I know you've covered this numerous times at the Glendale Cherry Creek Chronicle. So Denver, you know, Mayor Johnson announces all these rosy programs for affordable housing. Well, if you're the developer, all you have to do is buy your way out of it, right? You can sort of pay. It's sort of like when you were a Catholic a long time ago. If you sinned, you could just pay, you know, and then the sin was forgiven. So this is like, if you didn't want to act, because really, if you're building,
that's coming up in our next conversation.
Okay.
If buying your way out of a sin.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's not the indulgences are not just for the 15th century. Indulgences.
Well, but that's the thing. And that's the thing. So what happens is so the government, you know, Mayor Johnson says, oh, we have to have affordable housing. The developer says, okay, that's cool with us. But you know what? Nobody who's living in a $500,000, like a, you know, townhome wants to have the second floor being $70,000 townhomes, right? That's bad for their property value. So all they do is the developer pays a surcharge, essentially, or an indulgence. And then the developer simply passes that cost on. So what was going to be a $500,000 condo in the first place now is a $600,000. I mean, it's a joke.
Well, they're going to increase.
And now no more parking. You don't have to have parking spaces when you build in Denver. Yeah. So what that certainly won't, you know, because we can all ride our bikes on all those brand new bike lanes they
especially
have.
Especially in those nice cold days.
With the snow. one thing, there's a bunch of stuff going on today. Interestingly, the Colorado Republican Party, we talked to Dave on Friday, talking about the Denver or the Greenwood Village police investigation into the Rhino Town Hall that incited a crazy, well, I don't know if he's crazy, but incited a guy to start threatening to like literally murder the Colorado Republican.
Well, he didn't say murder. He said yeah, fuck you up. Yeah.
Right. And that they were in danger.
Don't ever commit anything.
Right. Well, and then he was comparing what he wanted to do to the healthcare.
Yeah, exactly.
The healthcare CEO. So that's pretty vague. Police are looking into that. I mean, Dave, they've been working on this, but they announced today the formation of an anti-corruption unit headed by our favorite Matt Arnold, the former head of a campaign integrity watchdog. And I think we'll get him on either Wednesday or Friday.
Yeah.
But what Dave wants to do is, he said, essentially, they want to this committee, the Republican Party committee, is going to be dedicated to rooting out and ensuring accountability in the state party. And they're going to start with investigating the attempted coup and the failed civil war and all of the impact that had. Well, and where did all that money go?
They lost that. They're threats of violence.
Right. And then all of that instigated by the fringe minority, and they're naming names again, Todd Watkins, Nancy Pelosi, and Eli Bremmer. And I think that's good, right? If these guys, it's one thing to, within the structure of the party, to go ahead and disagree. It's one thing to say, we're going to put up another candidate, but it's an entirely different thing when you're spewing the kind of rhetoric and the hatred that these people put out when you're trying to get rid of.
And then it's copied by the sad kind of yelpers like Joy Overbeck. I mean, she's just, you know, she's part of that whole thing where they just bark along. And they came, who? Us? We didn't know.
Yeah, we didn't need anything. It's like, right, it's like they said, KBB needs to be taken to court. I think they're working on that. Yeah, Sandra says, I keep missing your great shows. Well, chuckandjulie.com, Sandra, or Podbean or Rumble, wherever, was stunned at what happened to Dave and all. Thank you. Always happen. I can listen on Rumble. But I think, so they're going to look into that, and they're going to, and I think that's good, because it's like, who was paying for all of that, right? The lawyers, the lawsuits that those people launched, the renting, at least the meetings that they were holding, somebody was paying for that. And if you can, and this is what Matt Arnold does better than anybody, right? He was campaign integrity watchdog. He knows how to follow the money and particularly follow the dark money. Because I think if we can, how do I say it? If you're going to start funding this kind of thing to destroy the Colorado Republican Party under the guise of saving the Colorado Republican Party, then that needs to be
Unity.
exposed. Yeah, under the guise of
Los
unity.
Alamos, the head of Los Alamos. Unity by destruction.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, so that's up, and we'll keep you up to date on that. And I think we'll try to get Matt Arnold on Wednesday or Friday.
Right.
I see you were bringing something up on your computer.
I am.
Okay.
One of the great victories for the Republican Party.
Well, and Jacob, we'll get you in a second here. Hang on. Okay.
Oh God, Jacob, I don't want to stop in the middle of it. Go ahead, Jacob.
Okay, Jacob, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say something on your guest's thing. It was Clinton that wrote this letter to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac not to redline anybody and to offer everybody these loans, whether they deserve them or not. And it was actually Bush 43 that tried to stop it, but Congress kept getting in his way, and they said, "No, there's no such thing as a cheap loan." So they just let it continue until 2006, and then boom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, and I
Well,
guess.
certainly George Bush was not a savior. George Bush pushed the idea of affordable home ownership for the people who cannot afford it. And he helped create the crash. I mean, he's one of the villains of the deal.
No, that's, well, that's like, and as you pointed out, it's, everybody was getting these rates. They were great at first, and there was no like qualification, right? It's like there was, because I was like, how could a bank, because I was saying this to my realtor, how could any kind of lending institution look at her income and even remotely assume that I could pay for this, once the interest rate changed? And he's like, doesn't matter, Julie.
Because no, the ARM was started out at 2.25% for 3 years.
Right.
Now you just had to make sure that at the end of the 3 years.
We lost you. Well, here's the thing. What was interesting, Jacob, is so I just had to make sure, like, as a reasonable, responsible person, that when it went up to whatever it was going to go up to, that I could afford that, which of course I knew I wasn't going to be able to,
Right.
short of winning the lottery. But it was
What's
just,
reselling?
well, yeah. But then if that arm didn't go down, I mean, it was all of a sudden I'm in a $500,000 house. And I mean, even I could see, knowing very little about any of this, that like I was looking at foreclosure. And the realtor is like, and he was saying, you're right, Julie, don't do this. But he was like, they don't care. They don't care right now. He's like, it's a nightmare. He said, it's gonna, he's like,
I
sooner or
lost
later.
you there, but I
Oh,
just
go
want to
ahead.
say that the one thing I learned in the public trustee system was that when you had to discuss the
We're losing you again.
bank, we would facilitate them foreclosure. Anyway, one of the mortgage people told me the best loan to get at that time was a 10-1 loan because it was at 2.5% like the ARM, as an ARM, but you had 10 years to pay it off. And I
Oh.
really lucked out on that. That was a great thing because by the time the 10 years were over, in 2015, the 30-year rates had gone down to about 4%. So it
Ah.
wasn't much of a up, so that was it.
Right. All right. Hey, Jacob, thank you. That's really interesting. Thank you. Appreciate it. Night.
All right. One of the great victories in Colorado and nationwide is the victory where we live, CD8. Of Gabe Evans winning by a very small margin over Carville.
Flip in the seat.
Here's the problem. Whenever we win, we lose.
Not whenever, but many times.
Many times. Gabe Evans is a crooked cop, if there ever was one. He'll say anything, he'll lie, cheat, prevaricate, because he has money behind him that allow him to do it, which is Americans for Prosperity. Americans for Prosperity, which was the Koch brothers, and now it's just simply Charles Koch, believes in no government regulation or very little, which I probably agree with. But it also believes in massive trade with China, so no tariffs. He hates tariffs. And he wants a massive labor pool within the United
Cheap
States in
labor.
order to cheap labor, in order to build houses, build whatever you want. So that is what he wants, and he elected three people from Colorado. He got three people elected.
Americans for Prosperity.
Americans for Prosperity did. And Gabe Evans even had the endorsement of Donald Trump, and lucky he did because he won. But the scumball, and he is a human scumball, corrupt cops are the worst kind of cops. So his very first,
But I'm going to back up one second because I agree with you on Gabe Evans politically. I just don't, I have no indication that he was a corrupt cop. Okay.
crooked cop means ones that lie and cheat and
Okay.
so
Okay.
forth.
So here's
He
your
didn't
computer's
take
going to go
bribes
out.
necessarily.
Okay. All right. I just
No,
wanted to clarify
not
that.
in that sense of crooked cop, but a former cop who will come up to and lie to your face is a crooked cop. And so he said in his very first email to all his new constituents, which is prioritizing these three ways to fix our immigration system, which will help protect Coloradans. So he went right to the betrayal, right to the knife in the back. And the key to Republicans, you have to remember, is that you do Democratic things, you do what the Democrats want, but you use Republican language. You've got to make sure that where you're screwing everybody, you're making it sound like you're Trumpian Republican. So he says, we got to fix the border wall, and we have to secure our border, secure. And then what we have to do is we have to prioritize. This is the key, prioritize. And so we must go out and arrest and deport criminals, criminals that have committed crimes, major crimes in the United States. Now, what percentage of all the immigrations have criminal records? Not a large one. It doesn't take, I mean, if you have a 50% criminal rate, that's unbelievable. Your society is dead. So if you have 15%, 10% people who are out busily committing crimes, that 90% means they're not. And moreover, you have to have a conviction, they have to be caught. So
Right.
his idea, this is his idea. Destroy all of us and help Mike Johnson. If you cross the border illegally, then it should be similar to a minor misdemeanor.
That's what he's proposing.
You pay a fine, a small fine, and then you're put on quote unquote probation.
Do you get to stay?
Until you become legal, which could be 20 years, 30 years, or he would make it very fast. So how quickly could you secure a border when all you have to do is get around that wall and then you're scot home free? You pay a minor fine, which is a fraction of what you paid the coyote to get here, and then you're in like Flint. So like a place like Mayer.
Well, that
How?
doesn't mean they catch you in the first place.
Hi.
Right. Oh, go ahead, Charlene.
Can I just say that I'm really surprised that you're shocked at this because, Koch brothers, when Nikki Haley didn't get through, they said they were going to focus on the congressional
Right.
races.
No,
And
we
that,
talked about that. You're right.
yes, that was to preserve their Koch first agenda, not Americans for Prosperity, Americans for Koch Prosperity. And what you said, when you say Koch is anti-regulation, actually they're not. If
Well,
you've ever
they're
read.
against regulate. They're for regulating their competitor.
Competitors. Exactly. They
regulate their competitors.
Yes.
They push legislation that helps them get a leg up
Right.
on the
Yes.
competition.
Yes.
And I just read this book, Kochland, and it explains how they have done that. And when they were even in the Tea Party, they were rallying grassroots to help them get people elected to pass their legislation, not their regulation that benefited them and helped them get the leg up. And so, I'm not surprised by any of this. And the only answer I see to it is, like you said many years ago, is we need our own billionaire. And by that, someone like the great
Elon
guy,
Musk.
Elon Musk, and he will need to do these political nonprofits, like it's going to be like Americans for Musk Prosperity. He needs to set up a Steamboat Springs in Colorado. He needs to set up Independence Institute. Those sort of things that help build up these leaders that are anti-MAGA but claim to be for America, but really they're for the globalist. And that's what I'm looking forward to. And Co and Musk has said that he is going to challenge any of these people who give Trump a hard time. He is going to challenge them on their next reelection bid. So I think, you know, we need to get the word out. If these people don't want to build up America at the expense of China, as opposed to building up China at the expense of America, they need to know that Musk is going to have is going to be funding candidates right. to oppose them. And that's really all we can do right now, because they are fulfilling their mission, which was
right. I'll tell you what you can do. You can write to Gabe Evans and saying you're not fooling anybody. Don't give us. He does care.
Okay.
He won by a few hundred votes. I promise you.
Good point.
He cares. Right.
And he's only in there for 2 years. And so, so we might as well let him know that, you know, he's going to have opposition soon if he keeps this up. But he's doing what he was sent there to do. And so I'm not shocked at all.
He first sent this out in order to inoculate himself. First one out, nothing else. And if you read the three pages, you would have thought he is a strong borders deportation guy, and he's lying to you. He's dishonest and dissembling. What he's saying is, let everybody in unless you have already a criminal, then we don't deport you, which means 95% of the people pass. 95% of the 13 million pass. Which for the Koch brothers is a win.
Why not?
Cool. Okay, you can
it's
deport the
5%. It's all about the globalists keeping their cheap labor and not having fair trade. He's in your face telling you
how stupid you are. Hey, read this. You're too dumb to figure out what I'm really doing, which is on page 3, which make it like a misdemeanor. You pay a small fine, which is a fraction of what you paid the coyote, and you're on quote-unquote probation until we make you a citizen in 2 years. This guy is awful.
It's just another catch and release.
He said he believes in remain in Mexico, but watch how he screws around with that.
And what's so hypocritical, he's couching it in pro-MAGA terms because he knows that's where the country is. So he's using that to promote his anti-MAGA positions. And yeah, it's just detestable. But you know, I'm just the only, you know, leverage we have is like you got 2 years to do it right. And if not,
well, we don't have much, because quite frankly, if he has a difficult primary, this is the conundrum. This is why we always lose. If he has a tough primary but wins, he will lose to the Democrat. If somebody overturns him, they will lose to the Democrat. All our chance really right now is for the next 30 days before he actually gets into office saying, don't do this. We're not fooled. Don't do it.
We're watching in the short term. And then the big stick will be someone like Elon and hopefully more.
Because you're right. The reason that they're not threatened is because, as Chuck said, like Janet Joshi, right? Janet Joshi had no money.
No chance.
And so he had no chance against, because Americans for Prosperity, what did they put the price tag? I mean, Gabe Evans had tens of millions of dollars poured in. By Americans for Prosperity. The good news is, Charlene, like you're pointing out, this Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, these guys who have billions of dollars are also willing to put some money into primarying people. And so they can then push a candidate. And so,
yes, you know,
I think it's going to be sort of like the clash of the titans. Hopefully, Elon Musk, don't ignore Colorado. But I think, Chuck, you're absolutely right. In the meantime, we got to call it out and say, this is just catch and release in a little bit of a MAGA language, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, just treat it like a misdemeanor. You pay a small fine, you go on probation.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. These people have like the money. Here's what's going to happen. You're right. They're going to give him a ticket. And they're going to be like, you're showing up to pay your ticket. And like,
it's going to be like $80. He's talking about really minor fines. The guy can sell a couple of fentanyl pills and pay for it.
Hey, Charlene, listen, thank you so much for your call. Yeah.
Okay. But call Gabe Evans. Say you see through his corruption and dishonesty. We've got his, you pay a fine. We don't want to deport grandma, do we? You know, the nice Mexican grandma. We don't want to separate families. That's another one on his thing. No family separation. Forget the fact that Trump had it perfectly right. Great. The rest of the family can go back to Mexico, too. They can stay together.
Well, you know, again, it's like Charlene said, and actually, technically, Charlene probably were not shocked because we were saying this was going to happen. Because I'm surprised it happened so quick, though.
So quickly and so sleazily and so, and this is the worst part, so well written. I mean, really, unless you're really concentrating, knowing you're dealing with a really sleazy individual, and he doesn't write any of this stuff. I mean, he had
no, Americans for Prosperity wrote it.
Yeah. I mean,
he's curious to see how many other Americans for Prosperity funded candidates had the similar press release.
Yes.
The similar kind of thing. Hey, look, tragically, that's going to do it for us.
That's it.
One final thing. Trump says the government, Biden does so know what the drones are all about. I love that story. And we'll have more on that. And then Wednesday, we'll have Matt Arnold with the Anti-Corruption Committee. Thank you to everybody listening. Thank you to Todd Sheets. And we'll see everybody on Wednesday.